many people in society use incorrectly is positive and negative reinforcement. And they think that if they are praising somebody, that that's positive reinforcement. And if they're yelling at somebody, that that's negative reinforcement. You can have positive and negative punishment, and you can have positive and negative reinforcement. I have a headache. I engage in the behavior of taking ibuprofen. That then removes the headache, but it increases the likelihood that if in the future I have a headache, I'm going to take ibuprofen again, because it has, so that has, sorry, negatively reinforced my behavior of doing that again.
Hey, hey, welcome to the Bodies Built Better podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Tan, and I'm so grateful you're joining me today. This show is all about human performance. We explore the physical side, the mental, emotional, spiritual, and everything in between, because I truly believe anything that has an impact on the human experience will impact your performance. So it's my goal to talk about all the different things that could impact your performance, and of course speak to the experts as well. And today we explore the fascinating field of human behavior. As humans, we are very complex beings, and our actions are often influenced by a multitude of factors that sometimes we're not even aware of. But with the help of a behavioral analyst, we can gain a deeper understanding of why we behave the way we do and how we can make positive changes to improve our lives. So it is my great pleasure to be chatting with the wonderful Caitlin Ambrosia today, who is a good friend of my good friend, Josh Smith, who is also joining me on the show. He will be guest hosting with myself as we chat with Caitlin about all the different ways that we look at human behavior and human interaction and communication and all the things that we think we're doing, that we don't think we're doing, and all of the things that we can help to improve our own lives and the communication that we have with each other. We also look at the different habits that we can embody and create over time, and how we can slowly chip that away and get back to healthier habits as well. It's such a fascinating conversation and truly something that needs to be talked about more, because to be perfectly honest, before this chat with Caitlin, I had no idea that this was even a profession, that we could have a professional behavioral analyst come in and analyze the way we behave and communicate and help us make changes. So this was super fascinating. I know you'll love this episode. So let's dive straight in with Josh as my guest host, as we speak with behavioral analyst, Caitlin Ambrosia.
Caitlin, welcome to the Bodies Built Better podcast. Thanks for chatting with us today.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me.
Josh said to, it'd be great to have a chat with you. And he prepped me maybe 10 minutes before.
I had a coffee and I was driving in. I was like, this is what she does. Learn it.
Exactly. That's exactly what he did. You're a behavioral analyst.
Yep. Behavior analyst.
Yes. Okay. Tell us what even that is to begin with. Mm-hmm. And a bit about your journey getting to here.
Oh, that's a lot of different information to get there. So behavior analyst, I study the science of human behavior. And I apply the science that has been researched for many years. And primarily I use that with clients. Can you hear my voice shaking?
I can hear it. I can hear it. She's like, if I'm nervous, I'm just going to freeze. I was like, I'll talk for you.
Josh, tell her what I do. So I primarily work with children with disabilities that engage in a lot of different behaviors that are typically a result of not having an ability to communicate. So my specialty with these clients is primarily clients that are non-vocal, don't have ways to communicate, and therefore have engaged in extreme behaviors such as physical aggression or property destruction or self-injury to themselves. And I come in and analyze these behaviors, what they're trying to communicate, look at the function of them, and then put in interventions to teach replacement behaviors for them and teach a way for them to communicate what their needs are. The field of human behavior can be applied to absolutely anything, everywhere, anyone. That's just my specialty where I apply it.
So how do you even start with someone who, you know, what are you analyzing when someone's violent? Like, how do you understand what they are trying to communicate?
So say, I guess if it's the first session where I've just met somebody, I'll start with a parent interview first and try to gather information around when these behaviors are occurring, what happens immediately before the behavior, what happens immediately after the behavior. And I'll send like a behavior diary to teachers, family members, stakeholders in that child's life to kind of collect data for a week for me to see what these behaviors are, what are the conditions that these behaviors are occurring in. I'll then read through that and analyze it. And sometimes I'll ask a family to film the behavior if they can, to set up a camera somewhere in a hidden spot so that I can then watch the behavior. Or I'll come into the house, into those environments, and get them to sort of set up those situations that typically trigger behaviors. There's something called a functional analysis, which has previously been run in labs, but it's basically setting up all the different conditions of the functions of behavior. So human behavior, it all serves one of four functions or a combination of those four functions. So that's sensory, meeting sensory needs. Escape, which is escaping from an aversive situation or something that we don't like, escaping from pain. There's attention, so engaging in a behavior that gets us some sort of attention, whether that be posting on social media to get likes and comments, or standing up and dancing on a table to get people's eyes on you, whatever form of attention it is that you're seeking. And then the fourth one is tangibles. So access to a tangible item, whether that be money or food or toys, or, I would engage in the behavior of moving my hand to pick up my water so that I can access a drink of water. And so I look at, or I guess in the functional analyses in a lab, they would set up a control condition and then an attention condition, an escape condition, a tangible condition, all of those functions, and look at which one is causing the behavior to occur more frequently. And then they would know that's the function that they need to then go and teach a replacement to access that same exact function. So wow. I just do that not in a lab, but in somebody's home or in a classroom, and constantly just analyzing, why is somebody engaging in this behavior? What are they getting as a consequence of that behavior?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How long does it take to, like, are we rewiring? Is this a brain thing? Are we rewiring patterns? Or, yeah, what are we doing, and how long does it typically take to
then replace that behavior?
Yeah.
It really depends. Like I said, I work primarily with children with disabilities. So sure. A lot of the times that's autism, some form of intellectual disability, developmental delay. So for my clients, it completely ranges. I can have kids that pick up a new skill within a matter of, 1 to 2 hour session. And then it's just a matter of practicing that and enhancing it and getting it to go generalize across different people and environments that they can then emit that skill with other people, not just me. Some clients, it might take months to teach them something new. It just depends how much I have to break down a skill into smaller and smaller components to get a replacement. If somebody's non-vocal, I start with something that's really simple, like a sign or a body tap or an exchange of a card. And then I go into a more complex form of communication for them that is socially acceptable.
Right. Is vocal the goal with the non-vocal? Not really.
Not necessarily. It's just communication. Any form of communication that gets them what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you get into it?
Thanks. Oh, that's right. The basics.
It's been almost a lifelong journey for me. When I was in elementary school, I always just gravitated toward our special education class from, I think, when I was in first grade. And I would go there at my recess and lunch and hang out with the kids in that class and sing songs. I would give up my summers from third grade on to go to their summer school and hang out with them. So I've just always loved this population or been drawn to this population. When I went to university, I started to study, what was it? Physiotherapy.
Yep.
my undergrad is in exercise science and sports medicine. And I had a job at the time, part-time when I was in university, and I started working in 24-hour care homes and job coaching and all of that for people of all ages with disabilities. And from there, that's just always been a job that I've pursued. And eventually I ended up at a company back in California where my supervisors were behavior analysts and I loved what they did, but I went off and did other things for 6 years and eventually came back and said, I'm going to do a master's in this field. I want to be a behavior analyst. I love human behavior. I love watching humans, observing humans, figuring out what's going on. And yeah, it's just really cool.
So your undergrad, or sorry, your master's in this was in California?
I did my master's through Arizona State University,
mm-hmm.
but I did it online mm-hmm. while I was in South Korea.
Yeah.
Okay. Why are you in South Korea?
Just plant these little seeds.
Throw little things and then I just fade away.
I went to South Korea. My partner and I went there to teach English and just live that lifestyle and see what it was like. So we spent 3 years teaching English there. And while I was teaching English, I was doing my master's degree.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously you're teaching English when you're there, but what do you learn about the country and the culture? Do you immerse yourself in their language at all? Or yeah.
Yeah.
So you learn.
Oh, my Korean is shocking. I can read it. I can sound it out. I used to be able to at least give directions in a taxi, order in a restaurant, and speak to my kindergarten students in very basic vocabulary. Don't use it every day anymore. Yeah. So hardly know as much as I did at the time. But yeah, in 3 years there, we were taking Korean classes. We were not allowed to speak in Korean in the schools. They just wanted full English immersion for the students. But we would always join like Korean lunch clubs and things like that so that we could go and get language practice and understand. Yeah.
Did you have any preconceived notions of what South Korea would be like?
I had a few friends that had gone over and taught English and from, you know, their feedback that it was going to be, and this will get into another part of my history before Korea, but I knew that they pay really well for English teachers. The cost of living is extremely low, so you're able to save a lot of money. And we basically, my partner and I, wanted to have a good income at a low cost of living and be able to travel around the world.
Amazing.
While we were there, yeah.
So you're there for 3 years, and then you said you wanted to travel around the world. Where did you go and what did you do?
So while we were in Korea, we traveled around a lot of parts of Southeast Asia. We went to Japan, we went to the Philippines, we came down to Bali, went to China a few times. Traveled all over South Korea as well while we were there. But basically we saved up all of our money and I got a job here in Adelaide and we quit our jobs, sold everything in Korea and spent 6 months backpacking from Korea into Adelaide. So we went through Nepal into, I can't even remember the order now, but we went to Thailand, we went to Laos, we went to Cambodia, we went to Indonesia again, we went to Malaysia, we went to a lot of different countries.
Amazing. The 3 years, was that how long it took to become qualified behavioral?
No, so my master's was 2 years online. I didn't start that until about a year after we were in Korea.
Right.
And then the next part of, I guess, becoming a behavior analyst is that you have to do, at the time it was 1,500 clinical supervision hours.
Right.
Now it's 2,000 clinical supervision hours to get your license. And I couldn't do that in South Korea.
Okay.
There was nobody there that would be able to supervise me or for me to be able to practice my skills in English. I would have had to be fluent in Korean. So we said, let's go somewhere that I can do my clinical supervision hours. We didn't want to move back to the US. So we're like, what's next? And we haven't been to Australia yet. Let's go to Australia. And that's how we decided on Australia. And then I started looking for supervisors in the field that were willing to take on supervisees. Through our licensing board, there's a portal that you can search for people in different areas that are licensed and see if they're willing to take on supervisees. And there was a woman here in Adelaide that had that box ticked, and I reached out to her and Googled Adelaide, and it seemed like a really nice place to live after being in a crazy, chaotic, fast-paced career. We wanted something a bit slower, more chilled out, a lot less people around, more green space, more beaches and all of that. And it was just perfect.
Yeah. All of that.
Got it all here.
Much slower.
It's like, is this a compliment? I'm not sure how I feel right now, but I'm okay with it.
Well, my first Zoom call with her, she said, oh, it's a big country town. And that's what I've just heard constantly since being here from everybody. So
yeah. What are your thoughts around that?
Of it being a big country town. And I wouldn't really consider it a country town.
Yeah.
I love it here. I really do.
How long have you been here?
Just over 4 years now.
Okay. Right. So hours aside, you've learnt or you've had your clinical hours. Mm-hmm. What happens next? Is it something that you go, I want to work with, well, in the disability sector? Or is this something you always knew? Did it come about later on? Like, how did that happen?
I always knew the populations that I wanted to work for. Yeah. The company that I came here, spent my first 3 years working for, they were specializing in early intervention. So children 2 years up to 7 years, but I also had a few teenage clients. My specialty is really young kids,
okay.
Early intervention, prevention, before things get to a point where you have to do a lot of unlearning of behaviors. So that's where I'm happy right now. There's a lot that this field can be applied to. There's a lot that I would love to learn more about for the future. If I ever get sick of working with children, which I don't know that I will, but I might get tired. I'm not able to crawl around on the floor as much anymore and chase kids and have fun. But yeah, there's applications in like behavioral criminology that I would love to explore. I'd love to work in like prison systems and things like that. As well as, you know, we've chatted about before the fitness industry and how behavior analysis can be applied to, you know, setting goals and achieving them and changing those behaviors in terms of health.
Yeah. Which I'd love to get into in a moment. But something you said, you know, you love working with kids. Because you're working with kids and you would feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, that in the terms of the prevention stages, mm-hmm. setting them up for, you know, growing up, flipping that working with adults where habits are so ingrained, mm-hmm. would you say that would be harder or take longer to undo those habits, so to speak? Like, would that be a bigger challenge working with adults than it is with kids? Or
I would think so. Only because our established learning histories and all of the times that we come into certain consequences because of our behaviors, they get strengthened and strengthened over time if we keep accessing those same consequences.
Yeah.
So if a behavior has gone on for a really long time or for someone's life, you're undoing, you know, 40 years of a learning history of that behavior being strengthened. So you're going to have to, do a lot of hard work to really change that for sure. Never haven't worked with adults in this field. So can't speak from experience, from the science behind it, that learning history is going to be strong.
Yeah, huge.
There's so many applications, and that's what I find so amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think we had some beers at a pub and it was like 3-hour chat. So I was like, tell me everything, I got all the time in the world. I think one of the big things for me is that I've been around 16 years in the fitness industry, talking to a lot of people in a lot of different areas, that I'd never heard of a behavior analyst in this kind of field, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, psychology and whatever, like, how does it fit in that regard? Because one thing you said is that there's not a lot of people in Australia mm-hmm. who have this, whereas in America, mm-hmm. it's quite a pronounced or prominent field, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. Why? What's going on?
Yeah. What do you know that Australians
yeah,
don't?
Yeah.
Well, I was brought in on a skill shortage visa. So that's why I'm here, to meet your guys' skill shortage. And yeah, I think that it's a bit further behind here in Australia. This field, it's been around for more than 80 years. I can't tell you exactly when it started off the top of my head because I'm not good at remembering dates and things like that. But it's been around for a long time. There's decades and decades of research in it, and it has evolved over time. And it's very popular in the UK and in the US because that's where a lot of that research has taken place. Here in Australia, other states have a lot more behavior analysts. South Australia, I think we probably have around 20 to 30 now. When I got certified, I was the ninth person certified in South Australia. So it is growing. A lot of that had to do with there wasn't any masters in Australia for this field. So a lot of the behavior analysts in this country are from other countries that had studied abroad, gotten their certificates and come to Australia to work and live. Mostly probably 60% of my colleagues in the field that I know here are foreigners. But in 2019, maybe 2018, Menashe started a master's degree in, I don't know how to say that school's name, Menashe. They started a master's degree in the field, and that made it more accessible. So in order to become qualified, you used to have a master's in behavior analysis to then sit for the exam and do your hours. Now they're taking anybody with any sort of background, psychology, and just allowing them to come into master's programs. So they're definitely trying to expand here. There was no certification board. The board that I'm certified under is in the US, and it is a national certification that will change in a few years, and it'll just become an American Canadian certification. So Australia is in the process of setting up their own licensing board here, right. Registration, all of that. It's just not a recognized field. Nobody really knows what I do here. Unless you're part of the autistic community, I guess that's where the field has been applied the most, where the most research has been. So a lot of people in the autistic community will have heard of behavior analysis, but outside of that, there's not much exposure to it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of outside of that, like, where would you want to see it?
I think that it could go everywhere.
Yeah. I guess that's it.
Absolutely
everywhere.
Anywhere. One of the things that I think is really lacking here, is that, so in California, where I'm from, pretty much all of the schools will have a school psychologist or a school counselor, a school speechy, and a behavior analyst. So they're employed by the school. They're there to work with the students at that school based on those students' needs. That doesn't exist here. Teachers don't have a lot of training in human behavior, how to respond to behaviors, how to make sure we're not reinforcing things, how to use positive reinforcement as opposed to punishment procedures. Mm-hmm. All of that shift, I think, really needs to happen in schools here. I would love to see, first and foremost, probably behavior analysts in schools accessible to teachers that just need help with classroom management, need help with managing student behaviors.
What would that look like? I mean, you know, so one behavioral analyst in a school,
mm-hmm.
so how do they go in, how would they support the teachers? Are they, you know, in the classroom watching students? Are they only called upon when someone has a student that's playing up? I know that's not like the right terms, but do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like where is the behavioral analyst coming into the situation?
Yeah. Before I get to that, I think from my perspective, where I'm at currently in my role, I do go into schools and I would love to help train teachers up. Because I'm not hired by the education department, I'm hired by my clients' families to go in and support my client in the classroom, in the school. But because I'm not an education department employee, the school doesn't really have to buy into anything that I'm telling them or listen to me or give me that space because it's the family that's hired me, not the school.
Wait, so you can go in and there for the child, mm-hmm. but what, how can you support them if you don't have the support of the school?
That it's really difficult. And this is why I want to see this change here. Yeah. So, and all of my clients are NDIS participants. So then that becomes an issue. If they don't have the funding or the funding is cut, then they no longer will have that support at school. What I would love to see is that schools are able to invest money in having a behavior analyst there, that teachers can come to me and say, look, I'm really struggling with this student, or I'm really struggling with classroom management. Can you come in and have a look? And then we would sit down and do an analysis together and come up with an intervention plan and different strategies that they can use in the classroom. And then it might be that I'm coming in and overlapping with the teacher for a few days, or training up the SSOs for a few days. And then, yeah, just having, being accessible at the school whenever they need me, not specifically for one student, which is where I go in now, is just one single student. And I just see so many kids around that really need help. And I see teachers struggling, but I'm hired by that student's family. I cannot speak on any of that. I can't advise. I can't help out in any way. And then again, because the education department isn't recognizing of this role or hasn't hired me, the teachers can't really ask me for any advice.
That's crazy. And I think if more parents knew mm-hmm. that someone like yourself could come in and help not only the kid, their child, but all of the kids through supporting the teachers. Mm. I mean, you'd think that the education system would be doing something about it then. Mm. I mean, it makes life easier mm-hmm. when you can communicate with your kids and they're learning mm-hmm. because those needs are being met.
Yeah. And you might, I mean, a teacher might not understand that they've inadvertently reinforced somebody's behavior that's then going to cause the likelihood of that behavior occurring again to increase.
Yeah.
So if a child, you know, throws something and the teacher says, out of the room, I'm calling mom, you're going home, then that child's like, sick, this is how I get home. They're going to keep engaging in that yeah. behavior because it ends in that consequence of them being able to escape a demand, right? Then it becomes a strengthened escape behavior for them.
Ah.
And, you know, that's where that's a punishment procedure of removing somebody and sending them home. Yet it's actually reinforcing that kid's likelihood of doing that again, because they find going home reinforcing or having an early day reinforcing. And I see that happen a lot with students, especially students with different disabilities or that can't communicate. You know, they might bite somebody and the school's like, no, we have a no biting policy. You're out of here. Rather than like, no, what are they trying to communicate? Why are they biting? What else can we get them to do instead of biting to get what yeah. they want, to access their needs? So yeah, I think definitely having somebody that can come in and do functional analyses of behaviors and say, actually, this is what is maintaining this behavior. This is what's causing this behavior. How can we rearrange the environment so that this child can be more successful here rather than just getting rid of the exactly. problem, essentially?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. I was like, I'm going to get my phone out, just start like taking photos of your face during this tricky.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, how is this not implemented in schools by now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how new? I mean, how long have you been doing this?
I've known about this field for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been doing this in Australia for 4 years. I would probably close to 10 years previous that I've been actively in this field.
Right. And so you said when you first got here, there were 9.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's 25.
Yeah, somewhere close to 30. Oh, I haven't checked
yeah,
recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in the space of what, the 4 years
mm-hmm.
that you...
The field's growing, yeah. I've just had my very first client that doesn't have any sort of diagnosis, no developmental delay, no intellectual disability, no mutations of genes, like nothing. They're neurotypical child and just with behaviors that have gotten out of hand, and parents are like, hey, I need help with this. So it can definitely be applied. It's just that people don't know about it.
Yeah.
No
idea.
It's not that it has to be somebody with autism. That's just the community sure. that knows about it.
Exactly.
The most.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I need to collect my thoughts.
I know, I can see. How much of what you do then and how you go about it in this space, how much do you then work with parents to help them understand what's happening when you're not around?
Yeah, so parent training, when I'm just in a school, it makes it very difficult. Mm-hmm. Then my focus is on supporting that child in school and, if I can, training up their SSOs and teachers. Otherwise, I primarily see my clients at their houses mm-hmm. and in their communities wherever these behaviors are occurring. And part of my service agreement is that parents have to give me either 25% or 50% of the session time for specifically parent training.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't always start off right away. It takes time to get to know a child and start to teach certain skills to get to a point where I can then bring the parent in and say, okay, when they do this, I need you to do this and I need you to set things up in this way. But there's always a parent training component where I'm transferring those skills over to them. And that's one of the things when I program as well. I don't want to teach something in a specific way every single time, because then there's a risk of me having that stimulus control, to throw in behavior analytic term, that I become the stimulus that is controlling or evoking these behaviors from happening. I don't want them to only occur with me, or because it's my voice or the way I've said it or the words that I've used. And I've only said, the same sentence every single time that I'm teaching this behavior. I want to vary what I'm doing. I want to vary the materials, the environments, what I look like and who's giving these instructions, so that they're then able to generalize these skills across environments and across people and across times and settings and all different environments. So I'm always programming for that generalization phase. Mm-hmm. Mastery comes first, and then we look at generalizing into other areas. So it's teaching those skills first and then looking at bringing those skills across to different people.
And it's interesting to me. Well, interesting. No, it's important that you not control the environment, but you provide the environmental. So it's not just the client, it's the parents, it's the school, it's what's happening around them, mm-hmm. right? Which is something that I try to do at the gym. And you've said to me before, like, what you're doing is in line with what I do as well, you know, which is why my thoughts were, this needs to be applied everywhere, right?
And it can be. It's literally just human behavior, mm-hmm. human science.
Yeah. So, like, how would you then, if someone came to just say, you bumped into Jackie in the street, she's mm-hmm. like, I have these behaviors and I don't know what they have them for. How would you work with someone that is, say, adult without any specific behavioral issues then?
Mm-hmm.
And to help them work through some behaviors?
It's a lot of what you already do. So
pretend no one knows what I do. Okay.
Okay. So Caitlin, I eat lots of chocolate all of the time and I don't know why, even though I know I shouldn't be.
You don't know why.
I brought you in just to help Jackie.
It tastes really good. That's why. But really, the amount that I eat.
So you want to decrease that behavior of eating chocolate. Okay. So then I would look at what motivates you and how we put in different environmental modifications that would cause you to not engage in those behaviors or prevent you from engaging in those behaviors of accessing chocolates.
Mm-hmm. So don't walk past Haig's every lunchtime?
Potentially. But you can't just get rid of a behavior without a functional replacement behavior. So something that accesses that same function. So it's like, you can't just, you know, it's why quitting smoking or quitting alcohol, something that's very addictive, cold turkey is really difficult to do, because you're still going to have those cravings. You're still going to have that addiction component. So you need to be replacing with something else, you know, whether it's that you always have a water bottle on you. So every time you think like, oh, I really want to drink right now, you can have a sip of your water. So that's teaching some sort of replacement behavior for accessing alcohol. If it's chocolate, you know, you can look at like fading procedures where we're slowly decreasing the amount of chocolate day by day or per week. So it's setting goals. And then there's also, you need a reinforcement component for it as well, because that's the only way to strengthen behaviors and maintain them. So if the goal is to decrease how much chocolate you're eating, then you would set your criterion as it goes over time. It's called changing criterion design. And when you meet certain criterion, that's when you provide a reinforcement of yourself, whatever that may be. It depends what's motivating for you, what's reinforcing for you. It would look different for me and for Josh, for everybody. Our reinforcers are different. So if that's like, hey, if I can eat only 3 pieces of chocolate today, then I get to have, I don't know, something that you really like.
Right.
I get to go and do this.
So it's almost like a reward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. A reward system. Yeah. Rewards can be monetary. They can be, you know, time spent experiences. Mm-hmm. They can be tangible items, whatever it is.
Yeah. And what if it's something that you want to add? So obviously, you know, Josh training, you would get a lot of this, you know, people want to add training to their routine and get healthier. And, you know, how do we, you know, we've just given my example of, I don't want to be eating as much chocolate. What if I want to be getting stronger or adding a habit or, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Habits. So again, setting those goals, looking at what is your target goal? What is that final thing that you want to hit? And then breaking that down from there into smaller sub goals and building in planning for reinforcement for meeting certain smaller goals. Whether it's like, I want to get up and go to the gym every morning, I might say my goal is to do that 7 days a week, but I'm currently going 0 days a week. I'm not going to start off with, all right, if I go 7 days this week, then I get to buy myself new running shoes. Mm-hmm. Because for one, I'm probably just going to buy myself new running shoes anyway. And I'm not going to hit seven because that's not what I'm used to. I would start with 1 day a week and then 2 days after I've been able to do that consistently. And so it's, if you increase the demand or the expectation too quickly, that's when you're either going to get a resurgence of your previous behaviors or different adverse behaviors popping up. And so, yeah, if I'm going to expect that somebody goes 7 days a week to the gym when they've gone zero, we're probably not going to hit that goal. And then that's demotivating as well. Yeah, so setting up, I think that's the first step, is breaking down those goals into really small steps. And even as small as like, okay, I'm going to set my alarm for 6 a.m. and when it goes off, I'm going to get up and put on my gym clothes. And if I don't feel like going after that, like that might be my very first
that's
set,
good.
You know, like I've put on my gym clothes. Cool. Now I can go back to bed or do what I need to do. That's different. So it's like, and I break it down this small with some of my clients as well. Like we want to get up to somebody sitting at a table and completing a 15-minute worksheet, but they currently struggle to even transition to the table. So it's like, all right, let's go sit down. Bum touches the seat. Fantastic. Let's go play. And we're just reinforcing that very small behavior. And then the next time, once that's consistent, we look at, okay, sit down, do one problem. Nice. Let's go play. So it's just like, you can break it down as small as you need to. It would be looking at, you know, where are those obstacles? Where are those barriers? Why aren't they able to get into the gym if that's what we're talking about? And there's a lot of self-management strategies that can be brought in. I know a lot of people know about, you know, putting your clothes out the night before, having it all set up and visible, then you're more likely, it takes away the response effort of having to find those items. And, you know, it's right there, it's ready to go. So you don't have to go through all that effort of looking for your gym shoes and your bag and your keys and all of that. So preparing everything the night before is a like, these are all self-management strategies that are based in behavior analysis.
A big one for me, I think, on what you were just touching on is the four drivers. The escape, tangible, the other two. You're escaping from something. That's why the behavior's here.
Sensory, tangible. Sensory.
Yep.
So SEAT, S-E-A-T.
Yes.
Sensory, escape. Test time.
Oh, that was sensory. I'm like, am I being tested now? I'm not sure. So attention, go through it. Attention and tangible, yeah. So understanding them or having a little bit more of a awareness for oneself, like not just from a scientific work perspective, but understanding those things a little bit. I feel, I'm touching my phone, Joshua. I feel that for me, it's like, oh, cool. If we're looking at these four things, what behaviors am I exhibiting that tie into what these are?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want some chocolate or am I trying to escape my home life or my couch or whatever it is, you know, to understand that, to start thinking, okay, cool. This is the path that I take to get to this unhealthy behavior that I want to change, whatever you may call it. And then you can start to break that down infinitesimally to what's the first step in the right direction. And that might be putting out your clothes. It might be putting on a sock. You know, it's my gym sock. And then I take it off, you know, how small that is. And then finally reinforcing that behavior. Because from the gym perspective, and these are things that you picked up with me, it's like from the gym perspective, it's the first step is always like, oh, I just got to get to the gym. Because I'm like, no, you don't. You know, just, yeah, put your clothes on, right? Or just text me and say you want to come to the gym. And then if you don't want to come, text me again. And I'll be like, that's awesome. Thank you for acknowledging that. Mm-hmm. You know, we have it with our clients. And I was literally talking to one of my staff members last night that no matter, like, we understand the clientele and that comes from the interview process or talking with them where they're at. If someone comes to the gym, that's huge. And that's not something done before. I will celebrate that and we'll sit down and we'll chat. And then I'll spend 30 minutes. Then they'll go home. That's it.
That's fantastic.
Right?
Well done. Thank you. I love how much you use behavior analysis for that.
I get these little like claps on my Instagram every now and again. I'm like, yes, I'm doing it right. Yeah, you know, so like things like that where we're trying to break it down to the smallest step. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had clients pull into the driveway, wave, and then leave. Right, awesome. The next step is wave, step in, and then you build that out, that behavior. You know, and you reinforce each one. It's not like, oh, you came to the car park, then left again. You should have come in, which is punishment. And it's 95% of the industry. Mm. From my industry, that's what it is. You didn't come in, they shame you or you feel bad or whatever. Like, you shouldn't feel bad for taking a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. You should always feel good by taking a step in the right direction. That's how I feel about things.
I love how beautifully you summarized what I can't summarize beautifully. And a lot of what you're talking about is called behavioral momentum. And it is about just, yeah, that kind of snowball effect that once you get going, you're probably going to keep going. So, you know, if I have somebody who needs to go to swim lessons, but they don't want to get in the pool, I might just set a timer for 5 minutes or 1 minute even, and just build it up from there and say, okay, let's try it for 1 minute. And if after 1 minute you want to get out, we can get out. 1 minute goes by and then they're like, ah, I'm loving this. I'm already in here. And I set up that same rule for myself with going to the gym. On days where I really don't want to go, I'll say, all right, I'm just going to go for 5 minutes. And if after 5 minutes, I don't want to be there anymore, I can go. And then I'm not going to be upset with myself because I'll have made that conscious decision that I really just am not in the right place to be at the gym today, but at least get my foot in the door and then decide. And yeah, always whenever I don't want to do something, if I just stick to that 5 minute rule, I'll stay and do what I need to do, and I'll feel much better for it after the fact. So that's that behavioral momentum of just starting a behavior and then it'll keep on going.
Yeah.
You know, you want to do 5 jumping jacks and that seems really easy. Then you're going to be like, let me do 10. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me do 15. Yeah. And that's going to keep building on it.
And it's always harder to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, like for you to spend 5 minutes at the gym means you've spent 20 minutes driving, getting ready, preparing. And it's that preparation phase that subconsciously we're like, well, I don't want to waste that preparation phase.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm here now for 5, you know, and as you get into it, you're like, oh, I'm doing it now. And you kind of just, like you said, you just roll with it. It's the momentum. Mm-hmm. You know, I've set myself a 20 minute gym thing this year. Right. And I was like, for last year, I did a full reflection in January. And for me, I was like, I want to train more. But I know if I set myself an hour a day, an hour 3 times a week, I'm going to be like, I'm going to do that. Mm. So I was like 20 minutes, 4 times a week, because 4 times a week is more than 50%. And that's a step in the right direction. And you know, then I track it through my tracking and spreadsheet and whatever. But 80% of the time I'm in the gym and I go 20 minutes. I literally set my timer 20 minutes and it goes off. I'm like, well, I'm 5 sets deep now. Might as well do 5 more. Seriously, yeah, exactly. You know, and everything else kind of fades away because you're already in that moment, you know. And then so then from there, if it does get to 20 minutes and I'm like, I want to go, I've done my 20, I can tick that box, positively reinforce myself and be like, cool, I'll do next time, I'll do it, you know. And you can go from there. You know, but setting that the minimal step and then go from there, I think it's really powerful.
It's important. With another term to throw at you guys is the response effort of something. So how much effort does it take to engage in this response? And is the motivation and the reinforcement for engaging in that response high enough for this person to then engage in the behavior that they need to? And so it's everything that we've been saying of breaking down that response effort to be very minimal so that it's easy to engage in. And then once that's done, it's easier to engage in the next thing. I'll just take everything you're saying and I'll give you the scientific term for it.
I love that.
Yeah. Why this is something that is actually evidence-based. And it's just like whenever I explain human behavior to people, they're like, oh yeah, that's like, that makes sense. It's common sense.
Be like, no, it ain't.
But it's what we experience all the time. So yeah. It does make sense that, you know, if we're getting reinforcement for a certain behavior, we're going to continue engaging in those behaviors. Mm. It can be really simple, but there is a whole complex science behind it, but it can be really simple to understand. And it's just fascinating to me that this is actually a science, and it is, you can replicate it, you can test it, you can predict it, you can do everything with it the way, like it follows all the determinants of science of any other science would, you know, you can set it up and test conditions again and again and get the same results because human behavior is a science.
Love it. I don't know if this is the same thing or if you could apply it to this, but what about, I've got a lot of athletes who listen to the show. If they're trying to improve their overall performance and they want to add a new skill to it, but they hate the skill that they need to incorporate to get better overall outcomes, whatever it is, how do you change? I mean, is it basically everything you've just said with, you know, making the barrier to entry really small, trying to learn that new skill?
Yeah, essentially, if something's really aversive to us, we're going to avoid it, right?
Yeah.
And so trying to take things that are aversive and then pairing them with reinforcement will make it less aversive over time. So again, it is so much is about, you know, breaking it down so it's very easy and manageable in the beginning and it doesn't seem so daunting. It doesn't take a massive response effort and then bringing in reinforcement with it as well. That can change our whole perspective about something that is inherently aversive to us.
Yeah.
What I find super interesting is that if you're listening and you're thinking about, okay, I've got behaviors that I want to change or whatever, reinforcement is dependent. The behaviors aren't good or bad. They just are, right? And reinforcement isn't good or bad, just is. So what I mean by that is that if you're engaging in a behavior that is leading to a negative outcome, you're reinforcing that somehow. You're getting something from that. And so I think for me, like working that out and then, like you said, substituting it, changing it, whatever, allows you to go, okay, cool. Well, this is occurring this way, which has led to whatever I'm doing now. It's just a redefinition of, okay, this is bad, but then why am I doing it? You know, what's your reinforcement? What are you getting from it? And that there is what you need in that moment for something, you know? So like just thinking about things like that and like understanding why someone's doing something and not judging them for doing that is a key for me. You know, like you're eating chocolate, you don't want to do that, but you're doing it for some reason. What need is not being met? And then how can then, if you come to Caitlin or myself or someone else, how can then we
meet that need
and reinforce it in a way that is going to be positive for you to enable you to change that behavior? And what something you were saying before, which is something I'm bringing into something I'm doing, there's a lot of somethings there, but something I'm doing soon is you change and adapt your environment, your language at the points that the behavior changes. So if you're coming in once a week, I'm going to reinforce that and say, awesome stuff, we're going to go twice a week. And then you change what you do or change how you present that continues the behavior. Because if you keep the same stimulus and I keep the same words to you and I keep the same environment, you get used to that and then it's easy to fall back into the other way. Which is something I think about when I go through rehab with clientele. When I go through rehab, there are certain stages of rehabilitation that I'm not going to reinforce you going for a walk if you've got an ankle injury the same way I'd reinforce you doing some jumping at a later stage of your rehab. You periodize and you change how you talk and what environment you provide, but the outcome is still the same.
Shaping.
Yes. Give me the words.
Shaping the words. And differential reinforcement.
Yes. I had no idea that's what it's called. I just do it.
So you're shaping through... You know, we've talked about breaking goals down into smaller steps, more manageable or more accomplishable steps. That's first called a task analysis. So breaking something down, a complex skill down into really easy to do steps one by one. And then as we hit each of those steps, if they're still doing that bare minimum, that's not going to get the reinforcement anymore. It's steps 1 through 4 that's now going to get the reinforcement. That's called differentially reinforcing the new target behavior. So we're no longer reinforcing the original target behavior. We're differentially now giving more reinforcement for this. We might be like, hey, yeah, thanks for going for a walk today. But the big praise or the big reinforcer is going to come from being mm-hmm. able to do those jumps, because that's what our expectation is now. Mm-hmm. So through that task analysis, we are shaping skills over time into the terminal goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ooh, do you go in with an understanding of how the shaping looks? Sorry if I'm using it incorrectly, but you know, yeah. Do you go in, well, this is where we're starting, this is kind of the end goal, and this is where, you know, at the times we will change or transition from this to that. Do you have an idea?
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from just your own general experience in whatever field it is that, you know, so if I was to come into a field where I have no previous knowledge of working in that, I would need supervision to help me understand, you know, what are the different steps in between. With my clients, I'm very well versed in looking at those skill deficits and finding out where those gaps are or where splinter skills are, and looking at where we need to change things and train up new skills. It has to be individualized per client. You don't come up with just one workout regimen and give it to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own individual one based on what their goals are, based on what their capacity is, where their capabilities are, where their skill sets are, and what you can do to shape. So that's always changing for me as well. I might write out my initial task analysis to teach a complex skill, and it'll have X amount of steps on it. And then when we're going through it, I might then see, actually, there's another deficit here, so we need to add in another step here, or we can skip these steps because this person is able to do that already. So it has to be a very flexible thing that you're easily able to adapt and look at based on your knowledge of that person or that client, what they can and cannot do.
Mm.
Can I change behavior around language really quickly?
Please.
A few things.
Of course.
One of the things that everybody uses incorrectly, not everybody, that's an absolute. Many people in society use incorrectly is positive and negative reinforcement. And they think that if they are praising somebody, that that's positive reinforcement. And if they're yelling at somebody, that that's negative reinforcement. After a behavior occurs, there's a consequence, and it will either be punishing or reinforcing. So it's either punishment or it's reinforcement. You can have positive and negative punishment, and you can have positive and negative reinforcement. And that all depends on if something is being added, then it's positive. If something is being removed, then it's negative. So negative reinforcement reinforces something because it's increasing the future likelihood of that behavior occurring again, but it might be removing something else. A lot of somethings there.
Yes.
So say I have a headache, I engage in the behavior of taking ibuprofen.
Mm.
That then removes the headache, but it increases the likelihood that if in the future I have a headache, I'm going to take ibuprofen again, because it has, so that has, sorry, negatively reinforced my behavior of doing that again. If somebody praises a student or a clinic or client or an athlete or whatever, and they're like, yes, good job, well done, I love that, and they think they're positively reinforcing them, but actually that person's behavior starts to decrease, it's probably because your praise is not actually reinforcing to that person, and it's actually acting as a punisher. Mm-hmm. So just like that language around, you have to look at the future occurrences of behavior to know if something is actually reinforcing for somebody or if it's punishing. But positive reinforcement just means that you've added something on as a consequence mm-hmm. of a behavior.
I think you've really distinctly said what I was trying to say before. I was like, nah, 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 nah. Yes, thank you.
Science.
Yeah.
I mean,
there'll be a part two.
I think so, I mean I'm not a parent, but I can imagine parents listening to this going, oh, what the hell do I do now? Me,
like, call me.
Exactly. So tell us more about how
hit the link down below at the bottom of the screen.
Do you work for yourself, do you work for it? Like, yeah, okay, tell us more about how you do your work and how people can get in touch with you.
Yeah, so I started my own business last March, Oh my gosh, it's been a year.
Yay, congratulations.
And I started out with an idea that I wanted to work primarily with children 2 to 6 years old, in early intervention, really intensive therapy. Hasn't turned out to be that way, and that's completely fine. It's always morphing. Now I've taken on some roles of behavior consulting. So where parents are calling me or somebody's calling me up and they don't want that long-term intensive skill building therapy, but just help with behaviors. So I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to come into schools and do behavior consulting. I'm happy to come into organizations and train up staff if they need help around those sort of things. I would love to get more into that while still, you know, having my time to work with the children that I do one-on-one. But yeah, I'm open to all of this.
Amazing. Do you have a website?
No.
Okay, if you so don't,
an email though.
Yes, I have an email.
Great. So we'll put the email in show notes and links and everything. Because what you do is so important.
Yeah, thank you. Huge. I think so too.
Yeah. So to all the parents, I think it's the parents that are the key to changing the behaviors of the school system and teachers and just influencing them.
Yeah.
So if we can make or help parents understand the importance of your job and what you do and how you can help, I think that could really
it's getting a foot in the door and then being able to show schools through my results or show families through my results how important this is and how effective it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Caitlin, thank you so much for chatting with us. This has been amazing.
Thank you so much. This is really fun. Thanks for having me.
That was Caitlin Ambrosia. If you want to be looking or diving deeper into this for yourself or maybe for your children, or maybe you've even got a group, maybe you are a teacher or you know someone who teaches and thinks this could be really beneficial, please get in touch with Caitlin. I have all the links or the contact details in the show notes below. So please get in touch and let's try and make great change and impact not only our own lives, but those of others. If we can create better communication and open this conversation of how to communicate better and improve our lives and improve our learning situations, then our potential and opportunity and possibilities are really endless. So all the contact details are in the show notes, or if you're watching on YouTube, then in the description below. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it around, because the more people that hear about this work, the more incredible work that can be done out in the community. And also, if you love the episode, please give us a review or a rating, because it really helps get this podcast in front of those who really want to be hearing this information and knowledge as well. So thank you, as always, for tuning in. I appreciate you. Have the best day, week, month, and year. Stay awesome, and I'll catch you next time.